Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. Japan says it will provide nearly $40 million US to South Sudanese for humanitarian assistance and development projects.
We are extending our support to many humanitarian agencies as well as specific institutions, JMEC and UNDP, that are more focused on development of the country.
And JMEC says the condition of people in some areas in South Sudan is very bad.
One of the ceasefire monitoring teams, which recently visited Mundri, found people are starving to death. It worries me. I have read the news of further displacement from Equatoria to Uganda and DRC.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The government of Japan has donated $30.9 million to be used by non-governmental organizations to help the people of South Sudan. Japan says the money will pay for humanitarian assistance and to advance development projects, along with helping the country's transition into peace. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Koji Ito is the head of economic and cooperation affairs at the Japanese embassy in Juba. He says the nearly $40 million donation
is meant for humanitarian purposes predominantly, but we do want to make sure that this is used for better purposes, especially development and peace making efforts.
In a statement the embassy released today, the Japanese government says it will be working with more than 10 non-governmental organizations in order to help the people of South Sudan. Ito says the list includes UNICEF, the World Food Program, OSHA, IOM, and JMAC, the organization in charge of monitoring the implementation of the peace agreement in South Sudan.
We are extending our support to many humanitarian agencies under the UN system, as well as specific institutions, JMEC and UNDP, that are more focused on development of the country.
Ito says the money will be put to use beginning next month.
This assistance is meant for 12 months from now. We are going to disburse the funds in or around March this year. Depending on the agencies, the funds are going to be exhausted within 12 months.
Ito says the development projects in South Sudan include education, capacity building, and especially healthcare.
Healthcare, to begin with, in this country, the services were not adequate. We want to make sure that the capacity is also enhanced through the provision of equipment, that the healthcare personnel in this country will be able to take over from humanitarian agencies so that they can build on what we have done.
In addition to the $30.9 million donation, the government of Japan is also providing $10 million US for assisting South Sudanese refugees in neighboring countries. Japan has contributed at least $143 million US since the South Sudan conflict erupted in late 2013, according to the statement by the Japanese embassy. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Humanitarian aid is needed immediately in the newly created Amadi State. The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, which is tasked with monitoring implementation of the peace deal, says people displaced by recent fighting in Mundri are starving. The UN World Food Program confirms the deteriorating situation of the IDPs in Mundri, saying it has not been able to access the area due to insecurity. Gift Friday reports for VOA from Juba.
At the start of the second JMEC meeting, attended by government and opposition officials yesterday, JMEC Chairman Festus Mogae said people continue to be killed and displaced due to continued fighting between government and armed opposition forces in parts of Amadi State.
I was told this morning that one of the ceasefire monitoring teams, which recently visited Mundri, found people are starving to death. I don't know how far it is, but it worries me. I have read the news of further displacement from Equatoria to Uganda and DRC. In other words, I read those news with dismay.
Mogai says he is concerned that conditions of people in some areas of South Sudan continues to be there.
Every time I meet representatives of the humanitarian community, I am both impressed and disheartened by their information. Impressed because of the solidarity demonstrated, but disheartened by the fact it could all have been avoided. We have to act now to change this. It will be the truest affirmation that peace has come.
Mogai is urging the leaders of South Sudan to do whatever they can to ensure free access to humanitarian workers to reach people trapped by fighting between warring parties. Mundri East County Commissioner John Henry, who visited Louis Payam yesterday, says some of the villagers displaced by the fighting have started to return to their homes. But he says returning IDPs are in their need of humanitarian assistance, including food, water and medicine.
The quantity of medicine in the hospital cannot be enough to meet all the demands of. So there is a real need for food, for water, and the medicines for the people coming in, which have returned to Louis. This is really a major issue, and that it needs to be addressed.
WFP spokesperson Charles McDonald says her agency is aware of the situation in Mundri, but adds that insecurity there makes it difficult for aid workers to access the people in need of humanitarian aid.
The Mundri area has been facing insecurity. This has been well publicized. And as a result, our ability to reach people in that area has been limited. WFP continues to speak with all parties active in the area to secure safe passage assurances so that we will be able to safely reach the people in that area.
Rajab Mohandis, executive director of the local NGO South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections, say he is very concerned about reports that people are starving to death. Mohandis says the peace agreement clearly states that the two warring parties must allow humanitarian access in areas they control.
The parties are aware of the situation in the country. They should not wait until IGAD or these regional bodies and international community direct them on what to do. They should always follow the terms of the agreement, the text of the agreement, and respond to the needs of their people so that whatever they do actually improve the situation in the country.
The fighting in Mundri began about 6 months ago between local vigilantes who claim to be allied with the SPLA-IO and government forces. Eyewitnesses and aid agencies report that thousands of people who fled their homes in Mundri are either sheltering in Juba, Yei, and others have crossed the border into neighboring Uganda. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
The leader of the rebels of the SPLM in opposition is visiting Egypt today. SPLM-IO official says Riek Machar was invited by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Ezekiel Lolgathkot says the two leaders will discuss the slow progress on the implementation of South Sudan's peace agreement. Lol tells VOA's James Batty that Machar will also ask the Egyptian president to use his influence to mediate between the SPLM in opposition and the Kiir administration.
One, they can talk to Juba because they have influence over Juba. They can also talk to us because they also have influence over us. If you can recall also, Egypt was a former colonial power together with the United Kingdom or British. And now South Sudan is an independent country. Many of our leaders, they were educated in Egypt. So the role of Egypt is being appreciated by all of us across the aisles. So they can really help in talking to all of us, regardless of your political affiliation during the war. They can also influence us to make sure that this agreement is respected by all parties.
There was a meeting on Tuesday of the Joint Monitoring Commission, and the chairman, Mr. Mohai, expressed disappointment, the fact that this transitional government has not been formed. When will your group send in the pieces that are needed for the government to be formed?
We have informed officially in a meeting that now We are ready for our leader to come to Juba to be sworn in as the first vice president of the Republic. But now we want the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission and the whole world to move quickly to bring in the security forces of the SPLM-SPLA in opposition to Juba as soon as possible. If this exercise, the transportation of forces to Juba, will take a week, then my leader will be in Juba to assume his responsibility.
So, again, what is the requirement for your security forces to go to Juba?
It is going to be a logistical transportation. You can put them on barges with their equipment on the barges, and in 2 days' time, they can be in Juba.
Whose responsibility is that?
It is the responsibility of Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, headed by President Mohai. He is the one to make sure that all the provisions and articles in the agreement are implemented. And if there is a need for support in implementing any provision, he will be the one to ask the donors to support this.
On the issue of the 28th state, your group has settled to say that you are willing to dialogue on that matter, or is still a condition?
We have adopted the IGAD communique, the government, when I say we, the government of the Republic of South Sudan, and also the SPLM in opposition, all the political parties, we have adopted the IGAD communique, which is basically saying, one, take the security forces to Juba of the SPLM IO, two, form the transitional government, three, discuss the 28 states. And immediately when the transitional government of national unity is in place, the operationalization of the 28 states will be suspended until there is an agreement by the two parties on the number of states. And if there is no agreement on the number of states by the two parties or other political parties, then the provision in the agreement will prevail.
That's SPLM in opposition official Ezekiel Lolgafquot speaking with VOA's James Batty earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, non-governmental organizations ask members of parliament to amend the South Sudan Penal Code. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what type of student were you in school?
I was calm. I was quiet. I hardly talk much. I focus more on academic work, but I was noted for always playing. I played a lot when I was a child.
An outgoing student, quiet. I used to speak a lot. I used to love adventure.
Well, I was the talkative one. I always talk. And yes, I'm this kind of public speaking people, like this kind of students who just speak out and all this stuff. So yeah, I was the talkative student.
Actually, when I was in the school, I was one of the type of the school student that I'm very stubborn. But I want to be always the first in the class. My voice must be listened, and I want to be known, famous by everybody in the school.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Eight local and international non-governmental organizations are calling on South Sudanese lawmakers to amend the Penal Code Act 2008 to include international crimes. Rights activists say Parliament should ensure that the country's law on genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes match international law. Philip Thonaleu has more for VOA from Juba.
In a letter addressed to the head of the National Legislative Assembly's Committee for Legislation and Justice, the eight right groups say they support the initiative to incorporate international laws into domestic laws. But Elizabeth Asumadeng, a South Sudan researcher with Amnesty International, says the bill should use internationally accepted definitions of war-related crimes.
We are also calling for a few other crimes to be added to this bill, particularly torture and enforced disappearance. These are also international crimes that are not provided for in South Sudanese legislation.
Deng says it is important in a post-war South Sudan to ensure accountability. She says it has been documented that parties to the conflict deliberately targeted and killed civilians, committed sexual abuses, burned schools and hospitals, recruited child soldiers, and attacked humanitarian personnel. The groups who signed the letter say that kind of atrocities could amount to war crimes and, in some cases, crimes against humanity under international law. Deng says South Sudan lawmakers should clarify in the amended bill that there is no limitation on the definition or scope of international crimes.
We think the National Legislative Assembly should make clear that the crimes of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity have retroactive effect. That is that, you know, although they might become part of South Sudan's law this February, they will be applied to all of the acts that have been committed since December 2013, for example.
Under international law, Deng says, crimes committed by individuals 20 or many more years ago should still be prosecuted because of their seriousness. According to the amendment bill, genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity will be inserted into the penal code as subsections of the existing section 206 on murder. The advocacy groups, which include Community Empowerment for Progress Organization and the South Sudan Law Society, say this might confuse people, seeing these crimes are much broader in scope and may not include murder. The South Sudanese civic society activists recommend that MPs should consider either incorporating the proposed provisions into a separate chapter of the penal code on international crimes or creating a new international crimes bill. Joseph Amanya, who works for the rights group Human Rights Development Organization, which co-signed the petition, says domesticating international law will hold perpetrators accountable.
Especially the article in relation to genocides, espionage, and other crimes that are defined within the international laws. These laws, if once included into the South Sudanese penal law, it can become domesticated. That is the primary responsibility of each and every state, that you are actually supposed to punish anybody who has defined or who has committed an offense against the laws of the country.
A report of African Union Commission of Inquiry on South Sudan recommended the formation of a hybrid court to try suspects accused of committing or orchestrating human rights abuses during the 22 months of conflict between government and rebels of the SPLM in opposition. Amanya says that hybrid have no capacity to hold the huge number of atrocities committed during the country's 2 years conflict. Amanya says the South Sudanese justice system must be prepared to help.
We know exactly how the international tribunals act. In most cases, the cases they prosecute are not more than 10 cases in 3 years or 10 years. It becomes very much important for the government to prosecute some of the cases that the hybrid court cannot prosecute. That is why it is very important for the government also to have this defined in its laws.
The rights groups also want the death sentences to be removed from the penal code, describing it as cruel and inhuman punishment. South Sudan in Focus contacted some members of parliament, but the lawmakers declined to comment on this story, saying they need time to read all of the recommendations from the NGOs before speaking to the media. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
A group of graduate and PhD students took time off from their studies this week to come to Washington and pressure lawmakers to do more about preventing mass atrocities in countries like South Sudan. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Students from all over the United States held more than 90 meetings with U.S. lawmakers and policy advisors in a three-day summit hosted by the NGOs, the Enough Project, and the Jewish World Watch. Paula Queller, a PhD student at the University of Minnesota, was one of those students. She says U.S. laws have a direct impact on preventing mass atrocities around the world because they can pressure political leaders to respect their country's human rights.
By passing these laws, by passing the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act, and by passing the Magnitsky Act, they are trying to challenge the lack of political willingness that there's in our countries. So I have seen how the U.S. government has worked in these cases by having these kinds of laws and by bringing justice into our own countries.
High on the agenda at the summit was lobbying congressional lawmakers to strengthen the U.S. Atrocities Prevention Board, which was set up in 2012 by the Obama administration to identify and prevent mass atrocities worldwide. Mike Brand is the director of policy and programs at the California-based Jewish World Watch. He says the U.S. is uniquely positioned to stop mass atrocities from occurring.
I think a lot of people talk about atrocities prevention, and it seems like it's a daunting task that's completely impossible because we've never really... It's hard to prove the negative, you know, what have we been successful at preventing. You know, Nelson Mandela said, you know, it always seems impossible until it's done.
House Resolution 2989, also known as the South Sudan Peace Promotion and Accountability Act, was introduced into Congress in July, but has yet to become law. It's aimed at encouraging the warring parties to peacefully resolve the conflict in South Sudan. The bill has been referred to the House Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations, and is waiting for consideration. Former South Sudan Lost Boy and Florida University PhD student Jacob Atim says he came to Washington to remind Congress of the importance of passing the bill into law.
Some bills actually are close to be passed, but we are pushing, we are hoping, hopefully, soon. But everybody that I talk to, Democrat, Republican, this is not a matter of which party you belong to. It's a matter of bipartisan. We're talking about international issues.
Atim says while people wait for bills like H.R. 2989 to become law, U.S. lawmakers should take advantage of existing institutions to hold the leaders of countries like his native South Sudan accountable for their actions. Ian Schwab, the director of advocacy at the Washington-based Enough Project, couldn't agree more.
There's a program in the United States called the Kleptocracy Initiative that tries to do that, and I think it's a really important piece of the puzzle, which is not just the use of these financial tools to change the behavior of some of these kleptocrats, but also to be able to identify and return stolen assets back to the country and back to the people where they belong.
Sarah Cox, a graduate candidate at Antioch University in California, says she traveled across the country to meet face-to-face with members of Congress because she is convinced that U.S. policy directly affects the entire world. She says citizens like her have a responsibility to hold their lawmakers accountable.
For example, you know, with the anti-poaching and everything like that, it's like a lot of people see it as the wildlife that's being killed in Africa, but in actuality, like that money, like some of that product is getting over to the U.S. and the money, and it's kind of it's a much more complex issue, and I think that it's really important that we educate them because it is stuff that we do have a say in, and that, you know, our actions can make it better or they can make it worse.
It's not clear when the House South Sudan Accountability Act will be introduced at the committee level, but an 8-1 lawmaker on the committee said he hopes it will happen by this summer. The Lemkin Summit is named after Raphael Lemkin, a Jewish man from Poland who initiated the Genocide Convention at the United Nations General Assembly in 1948. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The Yei Electricity Cooperative last month cut power supply to its customers. The Yei Power Station supplies electricity for 17 hours a day. Now customers have electricity for only 6 hours a day. The move was made after the Yei Cooperative went bankrupt. VOA fellow Tito Justin reports from Washington.
YECO's manager Malice Lawrence says the decision to reduce power comes after the cooperative had no other choice since it did not have enough fuel to run its generators. Lawrence says due to the hyperinflation in South Sudan, the cooperative is now forced to pay £26 for a litre of fuel. It used to cost just £7. Sometimes, Lawrence says, the cooperative must import fuel directly from Kenya because of the fuel crisis in South Sudan. He says that means the cooperative needs hard currency, which is more expensive than buying in local currency in Yei.
We get that prices are very high and the people's income are very low and they are unable to pay. So that gives a lot of fluctuation in the number of users, and it is very hard to anticipate the total net that one you will collect at the end of the month.
Lawrence says YECO is making only a small profit margin and cannot afford to extend power to uncovered residential areas. Customer Morris Muki blames YECO management for reducing the amount of hours they receive power and at the same time increasing their electricity bills. He says the power fluctuates and even comes at times when customers don't expect it.
It's on right now. We don't know whether it will go up to midnight or it will go up to 9 p.m. The reason can be, okay, the economic crisis, we know it's going around and all this. We know this is moving on. But as long as we are paying, you know, somebody should not be telling us about we don't have fuel because we are paying. So the more we use electricity, the more we pay.
YECO customer Daniel Friday says he used it to pay £60 a month, but now his current bill is so high that he now resorts to using a candle in his house.
So it has gone abnormally that we can no longer afford. Recently, they charged us to pay something like £500 per month. So it's really beyond our control and beyond our control at home. So we have decided to suspend using electricity for a short while. Maybe once the economic situation has stabilized, that's when we shall get back to the usage of power in our home.
Lawrence insists the cooperative must charge its customers more money to sustain the cooperative. He says it's not to make a bigger profit. Lawrence says it's not unusual for the cooperative to encounter enormous losses at the end of the year.
Much of it that we have is just doing the project. The project implemented, and we have moved very far from where the project ended. Just by now, we should have expanded a lot of lines, and the whole town should be electrified. But we have very limited because of the resources that we are unable to fund our expansion plan.
YECO is a rural power project provided to the people of Yei and funded by the USAID in 2006. It was first managed by the National Rural Electrification Corporation, a US-based cooperative, until 2008. After 2008, the cooperative was turned over to Yei residents to manage. It has over 1,500 members, including private and non-private sectors. YECO has plans to upgrade the cooperative to include hydroelectricity power. Lawrence says that project will cost approximately $4.2 million. It has yet to be funded. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of our today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The government of Japan has donated $30.9 million to be used by NGOs to help the people of South Sudan. Japan says the money will pay for humanitarian aid as well as advanced development projects in the country. Koji Ito, head of Economic and Cooperation Affairs at the Japanese Embassy in Juba, says the nearly $40 million donation is meant for humanitarian purposes predominantly, but Japan also wants to make sure the money is used for development and peacemaking efforts. Japanese government officials say it will be working with more than 10 non-governmental organizations to help the people of South Sudan. Ito says the list includes UNICEF, the World Food Program, OCHA, and JMEC, the organization in charge of monitoring implementation of the peace deal. Koji Ito says Japan will begin turning the money over to NGOs starting next month. The head of JMEC says people displaced by recent fighting in Mundri of the newly created Amadi state are starving. The World Food Program confirms that the deteriorating situation exists in the area. It says it has not been able to access the area due to insecurity in Mundri. At the start of a JMEC meeting attended by government and opposition officials yesterday, JMEC chairman Festus Mohai said people continue to be killed and displaced due to ongoing fighting between government and armed opposition forces. Mohai said he was told this morning that one of the ceasefire monitoring teams, which recently visited Mundri, found people there are, in fact, starving to death. He says plans by the government to improve the nation's economy will not address South Sudan's humanitarian crisis. Mohai is urging the leaders of South Sudan to do whatever they can to ensure that humanitarian efforts are successful. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Anna Sudani by Sumeya Hassan.
حكموا العدل في الورى زمننا طرى هل يعود ذا الزمن ردد الدهر حسن سيرتهم ما بها حطة ولا ذرن نزحوا
We have been listening to Sumeya Hassan with the song Anna Sudani. I am John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus. from the Voice of America.